condensed in a very specific, material detail that has continued to haunt me. A piece of paper that the boy pulled from his pocket toward the end of his interview, the creases and edges worn. He unfolded it gently, slowly, treated it with the same careful precision a surgeon might have when making a decisive incision. He laid it in front of me on the table. As I skimmed through it, still unsure about what he was showing me, he explained that the document was a copy of a police report he'd filed more than a year and a half ago. The report stated, in 3 or 4 typewritten sentences, all in capital letters, and with some grammatical mistakes, that the subject in question raised a complaint against gang members who waited for him outside of his high school every day, frequently followed him home, and began threatening to kill him. It ended with a vague promise to investigate the situation. After showing it to me, he folded the document back up and put it in his pants pocket, rubbing his palm now and then against the denim, like he was activating a lucky charm. When our first day of work in court was over, my niece and I took the A train back home. As our subway sped uptown, along dark tunnels, through stations, past ghostly strangers waiting on platforms, the image of that piece of paper came back to me, insistently, with the strange power of symbols. It was just a piece of paper, damp with sweat, eroded by friction, folded and tucked inside a boy's pocket. Originally, it had been a legal document, a complaint filed by a boy, hoping to produce a change in his life. Now it was more of a historical document that disclosed the failure of the document's original purpose and also explained the boy's decision to leave that life. In a less obvious but equally material way, the document was also a roadmap of a migration, a testimony of the 5,000 miles it traveled inside a boy's pocket, aboard trains, on foot, in trucks, across various national borders, all the way to an immigration court in a distant city, where it was finally unfolded, spread out on a mahogany table, and read out loud by a stranger who had to ask that boy, "Why did you come to the United States?" News coverage of the immigration crisis eventually provided a general map and more precise numbers about its magnitude, but it did not clarify its deeper causes and consequences. It did not answer why. The very notion of this immigration crisis referred only to the sudden surge in arrivals of Central American children to the United States. From the beginning, the crisis was viewed as an institutional hindrance, a problem that Homeland Security was suffering, and that Congress and immigration judges had to solve. Few narratives have made the effort to turn things around and understand the crisis from the point of view of the children involved. The political response to the crisis, therefore, has always centered on one question, which is more or less, what do we do with all these children now? Or in blunter terms, how do we get rid of them? Or dissuade them from coming? Questions 9, 10, and 11 on the intake questionnaire are, how do you like where you're living now? Are you happy here? Do you feel safe? It's hard to imagine that these children, considered a hindrance to institutions and unwanted intruders by a large part of the society to which they've just arrived, soon to face a judge and defend themselves against a removal order, indeed, like where they are living. In the media, and much of the official political discourse, the word illegal prevails over undocumented, and the term immigrant over refugee. How would anyone who is stigmatized as an illegal immigrant feel safe and happy? But the children usually respond yes to those three questions. Working early morning shifts in court and staying up late together many, many nights, watching good and bad documentaries, reading reports, discussing research papers and news articles, my niece and I slowly began to understand the crisis better, in its hemispheric proportions and historical roots. One of the questions that we dug into most consistently had to do with the gangs all the children talked about during court screenings, La Mara Salvatrucha 13, MS-13, and the Barrio 18, or Calle 18. We read some more, discussed, and tried to make sense of all of it. Both gangs originated in Los Angeles in the 1980s, a time when the Bloods, Crips, Nazi lowriders, and Aryan Brotherhood, among many others, were already well established in the United States. The original Barrio 18 members were second-generation Hispanics who grew up in L.A. gang culture. The MS-13 was originally a small coalition of immigrants from El Salvador who had sought exile in the U.S. during the long and ruthless Salvadorian Civil War, 1979 to 1992, in which the military-led government relentlessly massacred left-wing opposition groups. We looked more deeply into the war and the struggle between the left-wing guerrilla group Farabundo Martí National Liberation Front and the military government. The primary ally of that government, we discover, and should have predicted, was the United States. The Carter administration, and perhaps more actively the Reagan administration, funded and provided military resources to the government that massacred so many and led many others to exile. Around one-fifth of the population of El Salvador fled. Many of those who sought exile ended up as political refugees in the United States, around 300,000 of them in Los Angeles. The whole story is an absurd circular nightmare. Later on in the 1990s, anti-immigration policies and programs in the U.S. led to massive deportations of Central Americans. Among them were thousands of MS-13 members, those perhaps quite understandably unwanted in the country. But the policies backfired. Gang deportations became more of a metastasis than an eradication. Now, the gang has become a kind of transnational army, with more than 70,000 members spread across United States, Mexico, and the Northern Triangle. The whole thing is a mess, a puzzle impossible to piece together using common sense and logic. But this much is clear. Until all the governments involved, the American, Mexican, Salvadoran, Honduran, and Guatemalan governments at least, acknowledge their shared accountability in the roots and causes of the children's exodus, solutions to the crisis will be impossible. Questions 12 and 13 address some kind of concern for accountability in U.S. territory. Not the government's possible accountability for political crimes, of course. Those are always robed in a cloak of invisibility or impunity, especially if they are committed abroad, and especially if abroad is a tiny little country in the Hispanic Americas. Rather, the questions address a concern for accountability for crimes committed on U.S. soil, in which a migrant's cooperation with the government might be generously rewarded. Have your parents or siblings been the victim of a crime since they came to the U.S.? And was it reported to the police? Victims of certain crimes committed in the United States, as immigration law has it, may be eligible for a form of relief known as the U visa. If granted, the U visa is a path to lawful permanent residency for both the victims and their families, i.e., the highly coveted family green card. Eligibility, however, hinges on the victim's successful cooperation with the government in the persecution of the crime in question. The subtext of this is somewhat cynical, and the terms of the barter a little unequal. We'll give you a visa for the substantial mental and physical abuse that you may have suffered as a result of a crime committed against you, but before we do, you have to agree to assisting law enforcement and government officials in the investigation and persecution of the crime. For victims of some crimes, real and horrible crimes, permission to stay in American territory is probably insufficient recompense, but it's better than nothing. It's certainly better than the right to a mass grave in Tamaulipas or Veracruz, for instance. The most common permanent residence, granted to Central American migrants who travel across Mexico. Most children arrive looking for their parents, who came to the United States years before. If not their parents, they seek refuge with relatives who have kept in close enough contact to still be reachable, relatives who may have been sending the money for years and who perhaps helped finance or plan their trip. These same relatives are the ones who usually receive the children if they're able to cross the border without being deported. And once they have the children in custody, they can declare themselves legal guardians. 14, 15, and 16 open a window into how the migration of children is reorganizing and redefining the traditional family structure. Do you still have any family members that live in your home country? Are you in touch with anyone in your home country? Who? How often? The family tree of migrant families is always split into two trunks, those who leave and those who stay. The ones who usually stay behind are the youngest and the eldest, though children as young as one or two, and some even younger, who traveled in the arms of slightly older siblings or cousins, have shown up in court. The ones who leave are usually the oldest children and the teenagers, following the adult relatives who went before. 17 and 18 refer to family members who might act as sponsors, or the people under whose care the children might now live. Do you have any other close family members who live in the U.S.? Immigration status? The immigration status of family members is almost always undocumented. This, of course, means that presenting themselves in court in the company of a sponsor exposes other members of their family to a system that they have been dodging, sometimes for decades. This guilt weighs on some children noticeably. Many ask during their interviews if their guardians will now be at risk for deportation. The new situation creates tensions and complications within families. Sponsors have to give all their details when the children are screened, from their names to their exact addresses. They suddenly find themselves in a position of utter vulnerability. And yet, thousands of children and their sponsors have presented themselves in court since the surge began. The states with the highest number of children released to sponsors since the crisis was declared are Texas, over 10,000 children, California, almost 9,000 children, and New York, over 8,000 children. 19, 20, and 21, on the other hand, refer to the family members the child lived with before arriving in the United States. Who did you live with in your home country? Did you ever live with anyone else? How did you get along with the people with whom you lived? The children's answers vary, and it's almost always necessary to reformulate the questions and ask them again. Because upon entering the country, many prefer not to speak of the familial situations they are fleeing, either to avoid the pain and humiliation they entail, or out of loyalty. But in many answers, it can be inferred that the people with whom you lived are precisely the reason the child was driven out of his or her home and community in the first place. And finally, question number 22 addresses the very nucleus of a family unit. Did you stay in touch with your parents? Most children give the same answer. No. No, they say. They did not keep in touch and have no idea where their parents are. Others didn't keep in touch for years, but then were suddenly living with them again. Familial reunification of absolute strangers. As the months go by, I interview dozens of children. The stories they tell me bleed into each other, get confused with one another, shuffle, and mix. Maybe it's because, though each story is different, they all come together easily, pieces of a larger puzzle. Each child comes from a different place, a separate life, a distinct set of experiences, but their stories usually follow the same predictable, fucked-up plot, which goes more or less as follows. Children leave their homes with a coyote. They cross Mexico in the hands of this coyote, riding La Bestia. They try not to fall into the hands of rapists, corrupt policemen, murderous soldiers, and drug gangs, who might enslave them in poppy or marijuana fields if they don't shoot them in the head and mass bury them. If something goes wrong and something happens to a child, the coyote is not held accountable. In fact, no one is ever held accountable. The children who make it all the way to the U.S. border turn themselves in to Border Patrol officers and are formally detained, often by officers who say things like, "Speak English, now you're in America." They're then placed in the icebox, and later in a temporary shelter. There they must start looking for their parents, if they have parents, or for relatives who will sponsor them. Later, they are sent to wherever their sponsor lives. And finally, they have to appear in court, where they can defend themselves against deportation, if they have a lawyer. There is one exception, however, one little twist to the part of the plot where children are formally detained by Border Patrol officers. The exception is being Mexican. Mexican children detained by Border Patrol can be deported back immediately. They don't have to be given temporary shelter, are not allowed to attempt contact with parents or relatives in the U.S., and are certainly not granted a right to a formal hearing in court where they could defend themselves legally against a deportation order. If a Border Patrol officer, upon detaining and screening a Mexican child, determines that this child, one, is not a victim of a severe form of trafficking in persons, two, is not at risk of trafficking upon return, three, does not have a credible fear of persecution, and four, is able to make an independent decision about returning, then the officer is entitled to deport the child. A Border Patrol officer can base a decision to deport a Mexican child on any evidence, no matter how substantial or insubstantial, and is not required to document a rationale behind it. The procedure by which Mexican children are deported in this way is called voluntary return. And as unbelievable as it may seem, voluntary return is the most common verdict. Other than a handful of lucky exceptions, all Mexican children are deported under this procedure. This irrational, if not completely absurd, practice is legally backed by an amendment to the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, which was signed by President G.W. Bush in 2008. The amendment states that children from countries that share borders with the U.S. can be deported without formal immigration proceedings. That is, if a child comes from either Mexico or Canada, he or she is immediately deportable, a removable alien. This amendment was Bush's last gift to American immigration law in his vast legacy of chingaderas, in urban Mexican slang, or nasty, shitty policies, in approximate English translation. Chapter 3. Home. Often my daughter asks me, "So how does the story of those children end?" "I don't know how it ends yet," I usually say. My daughter often follows up on the stories she half hears. There is one story that obsesses her, a story I only tell her in pieces, and for which I have not yet been able to offer a real ending. It begins with two girls in the courtroom. They're 5 and 7 years old, and they're from a small village in Guatemala. Spanish is their second language, but the older girl speaks it well. We sit around the mahogany table in the room where the interviews take place, and their mother observes from one of the benches in the back. The little girl concentrates on her coloring book, a crayon in her right hand. The older one has her hands crossed as an adult might, and she answers my questions one by one. She's a little shy, but tries to be clear and precise in her answers, delivering all of them with a big smile, toothless here and there. "Why did you come to the United States?"
"I don't know."
"How did you travel here?"
"A man brought us."
"A coyote?"
"No, a man."
"Was he nice to you?"
"Yes, he was nice, I think."
"And where did you cross the border?"
"I don't know."
"Texas? Arizona?"
"Yes, Texas, Arizona."
I realize it's impossible to go on with the interview, So I asked the lawyers to make an exception and allow the mother to meet with us, at least for a while. We go back to question one, and the mother responds for the girls, filling holes, explaining things, and also telling her own version of the story. When the younger of her daughters turned two, she decided to migrate north and left them in the care of their grandmother. She crossed two national borders with no documents. She wasn't detained by Border Patrol and managed to cross the desert with a group of people. After a few weeks, she arrived in Long Island, where she had a cousin. That's where she settled. Years passed, and the girls grew up. Years passed, and she remarried. She had another child. One day, she called her mother, the grandmother of the girls, and told her that the time had come. She'd saved enough money to bring the girls over. I don't know how the grandmother responded to the news of her granddaughter's imminent departure, but she noted the instructions down carefully and later explained them to the girls. In a few days, a man was going to come for them, a man who would help them get back to their mother. She told them that it would be a long trip, but that he would keep them safe. The man had taken many other girls from their village safely across the two borders to their mothers, and everything had gone well. So everything would go well this time, too. The day before they left, their grandmother sewed a 10-digit telephone number on the collars of the dress each girl would wear throughout the entire trip. It was a 10-digit number the girls had not been able to memorize, as hard as she tried to get them to. So she had decided to embroider it on their dresses and repeat, over and over, a single instruction. They should never take this dress off, not even to sleep. And as soon as they reached America, as soon as they met the first American policeman, they were to show the inside of the dress's collar to him. He would then dial the number and let them speak to their mother. The rest would follow. The rest did follow. They made it to the border, were kept in custody, in the Yalera, for an indefinite time period. They didn't remember how many days, but they said that they were colder there than they had ever been. After that, they went to a shelter, and a few weeks later, they were put on a plane and flown to JFK, where their mother, baby brother, and stepfather were waiting for them. "That's it?" my daughter asks. "That's it," I tell her. "That's how it ends?" "Yes, that's how it ends." But of course it doesn't end there. That's just where it begins, with a court summons, a first notice to appear. Once children receive a notice to appear, they have to present themselves in immigration court. If they don't show up, because they fear going to court, or perhaps because they have since moved, or because they simply didn't get the notice, they are usually removed in absentia. An immigration judge, assisted by a translator, informs the ones who do show up that they have the right to an attorney, but at no expense to the U.S. government. In other words, it is the children's responsibility to find and pay for a lawyer, or find a free lawyer who can help them defend their case against the U.S. government attorney seeking to deport them. A typical immigration hearing begins with a judge stating the basic facts. "This is September 15th, 2014, New York, State of New York. This is immigration judge, name of judge. This is in the matter of, name of the child respondent." Then come questions directed at the respondent, the child, such as if he or she responds to Spanish, if he or she is enrolled in school, and whether he or she lives at the given address. Then the judge states that he or she will be speaking to the attorney and asks, "How do you plead?" We admit the allegations and concede the charge. And what is the charge? Fundamentally, that the child came to the United States without lawful permission and is therefore removable. Admitting this charge alone leads to deportation, unless the child's attorney can find those potential avenues of relief that form a defense against it. The admission of guilt, then, is the kind of door that the law holds half open. It is the only way for the accused to begin defending themselves against a categorical sentence and seek legal avenues to immigration relief. The most common forms of immigration relief are asylum and Special Immigrant Juvenile, SIJ, status. If the child is eligible for either of these, he or she may remain in the United States legally and can later apply for lawful permanent residency and even citizenship. Usually, the kind of harm the children are fleeing makes them eligible for asylum or SIJ status. This status can be obtained in two steps. First, a family court must determine that they are impeded from reunification with at least one of their parents because of abuse, abandonment, neglect, or a similar basis under state law, and that reunification or return to their home country is not in their best interest. Once the family court makes this ruling, the minor can request SIJ status in the immigration court. Asylum, on the other hand, is granted to people who are fleeing persecution or who have a fear of future persecution based on their race, religion, nationality, political opinion, and/or association with a particular social group. It is very difficult to be granted asylum because it is not enough that these children have suffered unspeakable harm, that they will continue to fall victim to the systematic and targeted violence of criminal groups. The harm or persecution must be proved to be because of at least one of those four classifications. The main problem with asylum, the reason lawyers often consider it a secondary choice, is that if it's granted, the children can never return to their home country, where they fear being persecuted, without jeopardizing their immigration status in the United States. Less common are the U visa, which can only be granted to victims of certain crimes, and the T visa, for victims of human trafficking. If the child answers the questionnaire correctly, he or she is more likely to have a case strong enough to increase its chances of being placed with a pro bono attorney. An answer is correct if it strengthens the child's case and provides a potential avenue of relief. So, in the warped world of immigration, a correct answer is when, for example, a girl reveals that her father is an alcoholic who physically or sexually abused her, or when a boy reports that he received death threats, or that he was beaten repeatedly by several gang members after refusing to acquiesce to recruitment at school and has the physical injuries to prove it. Such answers, more common than exceptional, may open doors to potential immigration relief and eventually legal status in the United States. When children don't have enough battle wounds to show, they may not have any way to successfully defend their cases and will most likely be removed back to their home country, often without a trial. The interpreters have no control over the type of legal assistance a child receives. We listen to their stories in Spanish and note key points in English. We must simultaneously pay close attention to the details and find ways to distribute them into categories. On the one hand, it's important to record even the most minor detail from each story, because a good lawyer can use them to strengthen a case in ways that might not have been evident to an interpreter. On the other hand, although it's not in the protocol, we often look for more general categories for each story that may tip the legal scale in favor of the future client in a future trial. Categories such as abandonment, prostitution, sex trafficking, gang violence, and death threats. But we cannot make up the answers in their favor, nor can we lead the children to tell us what is best for their cases, as much as we would like to. It can be confusing and bewildering, and I find myself not knowing where translation ends and interpretation starts. During the interviews, I sometimes note the children's answers in the first person and sometimes in the third. I cross the border by foot. She swam across the river. He comes from San Pedro Sula. She comes from Tegucigalpa. She comes from Guatemala City. He has not ever met his father. Yes, I have met my mother. But she doesn't remember the last time she saw her. He doesn't know if she abandoned him. She sent money every month. No, my father didn't send money at all. I worked in the fields, 10 or maybe 15 hours a day. The MS-13 shot my sister. She died. Yes, my uncle hit me often. No, my grandmother never hit us. As predictable as the answers start to become after months of conducting the interviews, no one is ever prepared for hearing them. If the children are very young, in addition to translating from one language to another, the interpreters have to reconfigure the questions, shift them from the language of adults to the language of children. When I interviewed the girls with the dresses, for example, I had to break many of the intake questions up into simpler, shorter phrasings until I was finally able to find a bridge to communicate with them. Question 22, for example, did you stay in touch with your parents? Went through various iterations. When you were there, how did you contact your mother? What? Did you talk to your mother when she was here and you were there? Back where? Did your mother call you on the phone? Finally, she nodded, looking at me in silence. Then she searched for her mother's eyes, found them, and smiled. She relaxed a little and began to speak. Yes, she told me. She had talked to her mother on the phone, and her mother had told them stories about snowstorms and big avenues and traffic jams, and later stories about her new husband and their new baby brother. After that, we asked her mother to return to the area reserved for relatives of the children. Questions 23 through 26 are a little less complicated, though redundant, and the girl was able to respond to them less hesitantly. 23. Did you go to school in your country of origin? Did you go to school in Guatemala? No. 24. How old were you when you started going to school?
I didn't go to school.
25. When did you stop going to school?
I already told you I never went.
26. Why not?
I don't know.
I didn't know how to ask questions 27, 28, and 29. Did you work in your home country? What sort of work did you do? How many hours did you work each day? I had to find a way to do it. We were already halfway through the questionnaire, and I still didn't feel sure that a lawyer would take on the case. I reworded, translated, interpreted. What kinds of things did you do when you lived with your grandmother?
We played.
But besides playing?
Nothing.
Did you work?
Yes.
What did you do?
I don't remember.
I went on to questions 30, 31, 32, and 33. The older girl answered them while the little one undressed a crayon and scratched its trunk with her fingernail. Did you ever get in trouble at home when you lived in your home country?
No.
Were you punished if you did something wrong?
No.
How often were you punished?
Never.
Did you or anyone in your family have an illness that required special attention?
What?
The girl's answers weren't really working. They weren't working in their favor, that is. What I needed to hear, though I didn't want to hear it, was that they had been doing hard labor, labor that put their safety and integrity in danger, that they were being exploited, abused, punished, maybe threatened with death by gangs. If their answers didn't align with what the law considers reason enough for the right to protection, the only possible ending to their story was going to be a deportation order. It was going to be very hard, with the answers I was getting, to even find them a lawyer willing to take their case. The girls were so young, and even if they had a story that secured legal intervention in their favor, they didn't know the words necessary to tell it. For children of that age, telling a story, in a second language translated to a third, a round and convincing story that successfully inserts them into legal proceedings, working up to their defense, is practically impossible. But how does the story about those girls end? My daughter asks.
I don't know how it ends, I say.
She comes back to this question often, demanding a proper conclusion with the insistence of very small children.
But what happens next, Mama?
I don't know. After a few months of working with Vidor in court cases like this one, feelings of frustration and defeat began to settle over my niece and me. The numbers weren't adding up. There were so many more children awaiting interviews than there were interpreters and lawyers to conduct them. The ones we had interviewed now faced a shrinking window of time to find legal representation. It was clear that our only role in the court was to serve as a fragile and slippery bridge between the children and the court system. We could translate their cases, but we couldn't do anything to help them. It was like watching a child crossing a busy avenue, about to be run down by any of the many speeding cars and trucks, the two of us powerless to stop it, our hands and feet tied. One day, while we were walking to the train station, my niece said, "You know, I think I'm going to major in law instead of social work." "Why law?" I asked. My question was unnecessary. I already knew the answer. It's lawyers that are desperately needed. According to a comprehensive report issued in October 2015 by the Migration Policy Institute, the majority of children who find a lawyer do appear in court and are granted some form of relief. All the others are deported, either in absentia or in person. What is needed in particular and urgently are lawyers who are willing to work pro bono. Because immigration court is a civil court, these child aliens are not entitled to the free legal counsel that American law guarantees to persons accused of crimes. In other words, that fourth sentence in the well-known Miranda rights, "If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be provided for you," does not apply to them. Therefore, volunteer organizations have stepped in to do the job. Either pro bono or at very low cost, nonprofit organizations find attorneys to represent alien children. A handful of nonprofit organizations are responsible for all the work being done to help undocumented child migrants, and what they have accomplished is impressive. But they can provide only patchwork support and cannot cover all the gaps. I realize after several months of working in the court that it is better to write the children's answers in my notebook before copying them down on the intake questionnaire. One boy says, "The gang followed me after school, and I ran. With my eyes closed, I ran." So I write all that down and then in the margin make a note. "Persecution?" He says more. "And they followed me to school, and later they followed me home with a gun." So I write that down too and then make a note. "Death threats?" Then he says, "They kicked my door open and shot my little brother." So I write that down too, but then I'm not sure what note to make in the margin. "Home country poses life-threatening danger? Not in child's best interest to return?" What words are the most precise ones? All too often I find myself not wanting to write anymore, wanting to just sit there, quietly listening, wishing that the story I'm hearing had a better ending. I listen, hoping that the bullet shot at this boy's little brother had missed. But it didn't. The little brother was killed, and the boy fled. And now, he's being screened by me. Later, his screening, like many others, is filed and sent away to a lawyer. A snapshot of a life that will wait in the dark, until maybe someone finds it and decides to make it a case. My niece and I almost always leave immigration court in silence. We leave the brutal and exceptional reality of the stories we heard and translated that day, and step into the business-as-usual reality of the city. The hum of crowded streets, the sirens, the subway screeching when it comes to a halt. Sometimes, only sometimes, while we ride the subway back, we tell each other pieces of the stories we heard during the day. Telling stories doesn't solve anything, doesn't reassemble broken lives. But perhaps it is a way of understanding the unthinkable. If a story haunts us, we keep telling it to ourselves, replaying it in silence while we shower, while we walk alone down streets, or in our moments of insomnia. The story that obsesses me is that first one I had to translate. It lives with me now, grows in me, all its details clear in my mind and constantly revisited. It's a story I know well and follow closely, but for which I still cannot see a possible ending.
This is how it starts. A boy and I are seated at one end of the long mahogany table. It is obvious that both of us are new to the scenario, both still uncomfortable with reducing a story to the blank spaces between questions. First, I fill in biographical information. Next to name, age, and nationality, I write, Manu Lopez, 16 years old, Honduras. Then, next to the words guardian, relationship, and current residence, I write, Alina Lopez, aunt, 42 Port Street, Hempstead, Long Island, New York. I look at the two questions that float halfway down the page. Where is child's mother? Father. Manu answers with a shrug, and I write, question mark, and question mark. Why did you come to the United States? He says nothing and looks at me, shrugs a little. I reassure him. I'm no policewoman. I'm no official anyone. I'm not even a lawyer. I'm also not a gringa, you know? In fact, I can't help you at all, but I can't hurt you either. So why are you here then? I'm just here to translate for you. And what are you? What do you mean? I mean, where are you from? I'm a Chilanga. Well, I'm a Catracho, so we're enemies. He's right. I'm from Mexico City, and he's from Honduras, and in many ways that makes us hostile neighbors. Yeah, I say, but only in football, and I suck at football anyway, so you've already scored 5 goals against me. He smiles, perhaps almost laughs. I know he's going to let me go on with the questions. I haven't won his trust, of course, but at least I have his attention. We proceed, slowly and hesitantly. He delivers his answers in a whisper or a murmur and looks down at his clasped hands or turns around to find his aunt and baby cousin. I try to convey my words neutrally, but every question seems to either embarrass or annoy him. He answers in short sentences or with silent shrugs. No, he has never met his father. No, he did not live with his mother in his home country. He has met her, yes, but she came and went as she pleased. She liked the streets, perhaps. He doesn't like talking about her. He grew up with his grandmother, but she died last year. Everyone was dying or going north. 6 months now, exactly, since she died. She used to take care of them in Honduras, but it was his aunt, the same aunt now sitting in the back of the courtroom, who had always sent money. How do you like living with your aunt? He likes her. But even though she is family, he's never really known her. She has always been just a voice inside the telephone. She called regularly from New York to see how they were all doing. I ask who they are to get a clearer picture. Or, in other words, question 19, with its respective branches, which in turn branch out into always more and more complex stories. Who did you live with in your home country? With my grandmother and my 2 cousins. How old are they? 19 and 13. No, wait, 19 and 14. Names? Patricia and Marta. Why do you need their names? I just do. Are the 2 of them still there now? No. So where are they? Somewhere on their way here. On their way to the U.S.? Yes. With whom? A coyote. Who else? Paid by my aunt sitting over there. Is she their aunt, too? No, she's their mother. If they're my cousins, she's their mother, right? The reason for the trip that the 2 girls are also now making, following Manu's path, doesn't become clear to me until we finally arrive at the last 10 questions. They're the most difficult to ask because they refer directly to the gangs, and it's at this point that many of the children, especially the older ones, break down. Smaller children look back at you with a mixture of bewilderment and amusement if you say, bands of organized criminals, maybe because they associate the word bands with musical groups. But the majority, even the littlest ones, have heard the words ganga or pandillero before, and saying them is like pressing the button on a machine that produces nightmares. Even if they don't have direct experience with the gangs, The threat lurks constantly. A monster under the bed or on the street corner. Something they'll have to face sooner or later. The teenagers have all been touched in one way or another by the tentacles of the MS-13 and Badio 18, or other groups like them. Though the degree of their contact and involvement with pandilleros varies. The teenage girls, for example, are not usually coerced into gangs, but are often sexually harassed by them or recruited to be girlfriends. Boys are told that their little sister, cousin, or girlfriend will be raped if they don't man up and join. I asked Manu question 34, the one that often opens Pandora's box, but also gives the interviewer the most valuable material for building the miner's case. Did you ever have trouble with gangs or crime in your home country? Manu tells me a confusing, fragmented story about the MS-13 and their ongoing fight against the Badio 18. One was trying to recruit him. The other was going after him. One day, some boys from Badio 18 waited for him and his best friend outside their school. When Manu and his friend saw them there, they knew they couldn't fight. There were too many of them. He and his friend walked away, but they were followed. They tried running. They ran for a block or two until there was a gunshot. Manu turned around, still running, and saw that his friend had fallen. More gunshots followed, but he kept running until he found an open store and went inside. Questions 35 and 36. Any problems with the government in your home country? If so, what happened? My government? Write this down in your notebook. They don't do shit for anybody like me. That's the problem. It's then that from his pocket, he pulls out the piece of paper that haunted me for so long. A copy of the police report he filed against the gang. He filed it months before his friend was killed, but the police never did anything. And Manu knew, because everyone knows this is how it is, that the police wouldn't do anything to prevent a second incident, or a third. That night, after the confrontation with the gang, he called his aunt in New York. They decided he would leave the country as soon as possible. She made him promise he would not leave his house during the weeks that followed. He didn't attend his friend's funeral. Miguel Hernandez has a poem called Elegy about the death of a childhood friend. It's not so much a distant remembrance as an obsessive conjuring of his friend's buried corpse. These lines drive themselves into my mind the way only the sharpest images can. I want to gnaw at the earth with my teeth. I want to take the earth apart bit by bit with dry, burning bites. I want to mine the earth till I find you and kiss your noble skull and unshroud you and return you. In the interview, Manu repeated twice that he wasn't at his friend's funeral. He didn't leave his house until the coyote knocked on his door and they slipped down the streets of Tegucigalpa together. His aunt paid the coyote $4,000. They left at dawn. Manu explains that boys cost $4,000 and girls $3,000. Why? Because boys are the worst, he says, smiling wide. We go over the rest of the story. From Tegucigalpa to Guatemala by bus, to the Mexican border, to Arriaga and then aboard La Bestia, to the U.S.-Mexico border. No serious problems along the way, although I imagine there were serious things that don't seem serious to him anymore. From there to the icebox, the shelter, the airplane to JFK, and finally to Long Island. We're about to finish the session when he suddenly reveals an unexpected turn. The reason his two cousins, Patricia and Marta, set off on the same journey. Why did they leave? Something in his body language softens and becomes milder, as if the thought of his two cousins has momentarily stripped away some of his toughness, an attitude that, with practice like this, may turn into personality. When he left, he explains, the same gang that had killed his best friend started harassing his two cousins. That's when his aunt decided that she'd rather pay the $3,000 for each of her daughters and put them through the dangers of the journey than let them stay. The dangers the girls will face multiply in my head, as Manu tells me all this.
Beyond the dangers posed by organized gangs and criminals in Mexico, there are also the federal, state, and municipal police forces, the army, and the immigration officials who operate under the umbrella of the Ministry of the Interior, and whose roles have been reinforced by new and more severe policies. Shortly after the unaccompanied child migrant crisis was declared in the United States, and after a meeting between President Barack Obama and President Enrique Peña Nieto, the Mexican government introduced its new anti-immigration plan, the Programa Frontera Sur. The objective of the program, which was granted an initial budget of 102 million pesos from federal funds, was to halt the immigration of Central Americans through Mexico. To justify Programa Frontera Sur, the Mexican government maintains that Mexico must protect the safety and rights of migrants. But the reality is something else entirely. In fact, since the program was implemented, the safety of immigrants has been compromised to an even greater extent, their lives put in a much more vulnerable situation. Anti-immigrant strategies included in the program, mostly to be implemented along the routes of La Bestia, include drones, security cameras and control centers in strategic locations, trains, tunnels, bridges, railway crossings, and city centers, fences and floodlights in the rail yards, private security teams and geolocation technology in trains, alarm systems and motion detectors on the tracks, and last but not least, the notorious Grupos Beta, which under the guise of a humanitarian aid organization, locates and then reports migrants to immigration officials who can then secure them, a Mexican euphemism for capture and deport. Programa Frontera Sur is the Mexican government's new augmented reality video game. The player who hunts down the most migrants wins. As the Mexican government has progressively increased its hold on La Bestia, travel aboard the trains has become more and more risky, and new routes have been improvised. There are now maritime routes that begin on the coast of Chiapas, along which the migrants travel with coyotes aboard rafts and other precarious vessels. We've heard the many stories about migrants crossing the Mediterranean, that massive cemetery of a sea. So it's easy to imagine what kinds of stories we'll hear in the next few years of migrants amid the enormous waves of the Pacific Ocean. Since Programa Frontera Sur was launched in 2014, Mexico has massively deported Central American migrants, many of whom would have had the legal right to request asylum in either Mexico or the United States. In 2016, for example, Mexico registered the largest number of applications for asylum in recent history. That same year saw a radical increase in deportation rates of Central Americans. This, of course, begs the question of whether migrants' right to due process is being honored. Most Mexicans, when asked about immigration issues, talk like they have either a PhD in Mexico-U.S. relations or direct experience with migrating illegally across the border. Mexicans are eager and tireless critics of U.S. immigration policies. And though most critiques of their northern neighbor are probably more than justified, Mexicans are far too lax and self-indulgent when it comes to evaluating our own country's immigration policies, especially where Central Americans are concerned. Under Programa Frontera Sur, the focus of border control for the Central American exodus is shifting from the Rio Grande on the U.S.-Mexico border to the Suchiate and Usumacinta rivers on the Mexico-Guatemala border. The United States, of course, not only endorses this shift, but has been generously financing it. The State Department has paid the Mexican government tens of millions of dollars to filter the migration of Central Americans. In other words, following the old tradition of Latin American-U.S. governmental relations, the Mexican government is getting paid to do the dirty work. And President Peña Nieto, the most well-groomed, cynical, and sinister boy among the subservient Latin American bullies doing the grunt work, has earned his place as the continent's new deporter-in-chief. Since 2014, he has deported more Central Americans each year than the United States, more than 150,000 in 2015. The country is now limbo for migrants, An enormous and terrifying customs office, staffed as often by white-collar criminals as it is by criminals with guns and pickup trucks. The next time I see Manu, 6 months later, we're in a large room on the 20-something floor of a corporate building next to South Ferry. We can see Staten Island from the window, and if we stretch our necks, we can see the Statue of Liberty. The setting is almost unreal, as if we've been thrust into a high-budget production of a Hollywood movie. Manu is grateful, his aunt asked me to tell the three men in expensive suits who sit across from us at the lacquered table. I sense his disbelief, and perhaps he senses mine, too. The lawyers who will represent his case work for one of the most powerful and expensive corporate firms in the city. Rarely do these kinds of offices get involved in cases like this one. But thanks to the material evidence Manu has of his statements, the folded slip of paper, the door was able to find a large firm willing to take his case pro bono. With that kind of material evidence, it would be impossible for them to lose. The lawyers at the door transformed a dead document into legal evidence for a case. Sometimes, when cases advance to this second phase, the organizations that work in the court ask the interpreter who did the first interview to rejoin them. Since Manu's new lawyers don't speak Spanish, I was asked to continue translating for him. I don't hesitate to show Manu my enthusiasm for our coincidental reunion at this second stage of his immigration process. I tell him about another coincidence. I'm now working at a university in Hempstead, the same city in Long Island where he lives. He receives my enthusiasm without a word, maintaining his cool. We sit around a large black table. Manu, his aunt, three lawyers, and me. We are offered coffee and snacks. Alina and I say yes to the coffee. Manu says he'll have some of everything if it's free. I translate. Just a cookie, please. Thanks, that's very kind of you. The meeting serves the sole purpose of preparing Manu's SIJ status application, though he's probably more likely eligible for asylum. We go through the lawyer's contract and then through his application. Everything runs smoothly until the lawyers ask if Manu is still enrolled in school. He is, he says. He's at Hempstead High School, but he wants to leave as soon as possible. Why? They want to know. They remind him that if he wants to be considered for any type of formal relief, he has to be enrolled in school. He answers slowly and in a low voice, but perhaps more confidently than when I first met him in court months ago. He looks down at his clasped hands now and again as he talks. Hempstead High School, he tells us, is a hub for MS-13 and Barrio 18. I go cold at hearing this statement, which he delivers in the tone one might use to talk about items in a supermarket. He's afraid of Barrio 18, but doesn't want to join MS-13 either, even though they are not as bad. Suddenly, we all suspect Manu and want to ask question 37. Have you ever been a member of a gang? Any tattoos? No, he has no tattoos. And no, he's never been part of a gang. Indeed, it turns out Manu has good reasons to be afraid. Later, members of Barrio 18 beat him up. When he tells me about this incident, he's missing his two front teeth. Showing the wide gap and trying to joke about it, he says, I used to laugh at my grandma because she had no front teeth, and now I look in the mirror, and I laugh at me. After the incident with Barrio 18 in Hempstead, his aunt Alina worried he would end up in trouble because MS-13 boys saved him from losing the rest of his teeth, and now he owes them something. When I ask him about it, he says the MS-13 in Hempstead wants him, yes, but he's not going to fall for it. He'd rather disappear than join them, now more than ever. What do you mean by now more than ever, Manu? I ask. I mean, now that my two cousins are here with us, and I have to look out for them. Look out for them how? Just look out for them, because Hempstead is a shithole full of pandilleros, just like Tegucigalpa. Between Hempstead and Tegucigalpa, there is a long chain of causes and effects. Both cities can be drawn on the same map. the map of violence related to drug trafficking. This fact is ignored, however, by almost all of the official reports. The media